ॐ सहना भवतु सहना भुनक्तु सह वीर्यं करवावहै तेजस्विनावधीतमस्तु मा विद्विषावहै ॐ शान्ति शान्ति शान्तिः
Do you have any questions? Let me see. See if it's any new at all. This one's new, isn't it?
About objectifying the self.
Yeah. Okay. And then, please. Oh, this one we've done. I'm sure of that. Okay. This is good. Let's do this one. Can you talk about how the mind illumines consciousness rather than objectifying it? Can you talk about how consciousness illumines the mind rather than... That's what you mean, I think.
I get confused because you say the self is not objectifiable, but then I'm kind of using the mind to point to...
Yeah, I understand. Go ahead, tell me a little bit more.
Yeah, I'm not sure what else to say.
That's good enough.
Yeah.
I think I understand.
Exactly.
So I don't think I'm grasping the difference. Yeah.
He's not in behind
luck.
I think it's time to. Okay, you guys. I'll go.
Hey, come on.
No, they don't have those human rules.
You had a good time.
Did you see Switches scooting in right after lunch?
Oh, he did it to me too the other day.
Huh?
He did it to me once too.
Oh, yeah. Sneaky little guy.
He says, I might be little, but I'm not silly.
He knows the score, you know. That little switch is really quick and sneaky.
Mm-hmm. Can't have two. We can only have one at a time. Mm-hmm. Lucky's. Okay. You're okay. You can come back up. Okay. Okay, so. Can you talk about that? Okay. See, when we're talking like this, we're really just talking about how self-knowledge is gained. Right, that's the question, because the mind never would illumine the self, or there wouldn't be any way to make that mistake, that the mind is illumining the self. What is natural is that, and we don't really think about this either, but anything that's objectifiable in time and space, which would be the mind, your sense organs, any type of the ahankara, the I thought, memories, any perception, imagination, all of these things are known. They're known because consciousness illumines them. You know, consciousness is the self, it doesn't illumine like a verb, it illumines because its nature is consciousness. And so the nature being consciousness, when it is superimposed, or when the mind, etc., is superimposed on the conscious, on consciousness, then the experience in the mind is that whatever it is there is known. we say is known because we're not really identifying it with ourselves. So it's just it's an idamvriti. This I don't take to be myself. And so this that is the illumined nature of this, whatever this is known. That's the self-evident consciousness. On the other hand, if it's an ahamvriti that's taking place, I am like the ahankara, then I'm identifying the consciousness with myself. So non-dual consciousness illumines the ahamvriti, I am, thought, and it illumines the adamvriti, this thought, this. We call it in language, though it's the same consciousness, when it's the adamvriti, we say it is known. When it's the ahamvriti, we say it is me. So it depends on whether the upadhi, conditioning adjunct, is something which I identify with, because basically it's sattva. You know, if sattva, rajas, and tamas, it's sattva. So it reflects consciousness. The only thing that reflects consciousness in the subtle body that takes body after body after body really is the five sense organs and the mind. And so the five sense organs, you get that sense of knowership. I am the seer, I am the hearer, I am the one who is touching. And so I identify myself with the five sense organs, and I identify myself with all of my vrittis, especially vrittis that are identified with what we call an upadhi, a conditioning adjunct, or anything that can take the ahankara. So I can say this body enjoys consciousness, I am the body. So this body can get the aham, right? Because the sense of touch runs all the way through the body, and so then the body enjoys consciousness, so I say I am the body. That's all superimposition. This enjoys consciousness too, but not from its own standpoint. And so this is its relationship with consciousness is only it is known. But the relationship of say the buddhi to consciousness is both it is known and I am my mind. Because this even though it's known and we know it's known, like I'm thinking this or I am so sad or you know my body is hurting, that means I'm aware of my body as idam. I'm talking about it. My mind is doing this, that and the other thing, or my mind is having this kind of emotion, you know, or my sense organs are failing. Then that's all idamvriti. But at the same time, because it's sattva and reflects consciousness, there's the ahamvriti. The ahamvriti is the ahankara. I am that. So my mind feels so depressed or so discombobulated. You also can at the same time say, I'm so discombobulated, I'm so depressed, or I'm so upset. So whether you say, I am that, you can say, I am that, and you can also say, I am aware of that, and for you there's no conflict in that. We point out that conflict and make you understand make you recognize that self-evident consciousness never changes at all. And all of the vrittis and all of the moods, the emotions, the perceptions, anything that can take an ahankara also is objectified and changing, and your being is not. Just this me, simple me, is ever present and always the same. So now in this teaching we have to be able to differentiate these two that are appearing as one, kind of like a red-hot iron ball. If you don't know the iron and you don't know the heat, they appear as though they're one thing, taken to be one. So you need, when two things are appearing to be one, that's when you use this word viveka. You need to differentiate between two things that to you appear as one. Otherwise, that's the meaning of the word viveka, or discrimination. Two things appearing as one, we have to recognize the one and the other.
Do you mean the mind and consciousness?
Yes, well, it's the mind and consciousness, but it's also consciousness in the mind, consciousness in the thoughts, consciousness in the body, consciousness in the sense organs, consciousness as any objects in the world. But now when we're talking about like gaining... You're busy tonight, huh? When we're talking about gaining self-knowledge, what has to happen is that the buddhi, which is actually an object of consciousness. It's objectified, like you can, you know what you're thinking, and you watch the thoughts moving. But the buddhi, from its own standpoint, is totally identified with consciousness as its own self. I am a conscious being. We say buddhi instead of the manas and the emotions and everything, because the buddhi is where the knowledge really takes place, you know. And so how does the knowledge take place? The buddhi can't really just turn around and look at me, you know. It already is me. So there's no looking to be done. It already is me and is totally identified with me. It is me and it is identifies itself with me, and in doing that, I gain all of its attributes. Like, it's the buddhi is smart, or the buddhi is stupid, or the buddhi is thinking about this or thinking about that. I become a thinker, you know, just in reference to the buddhi. Now, so what has to happen is that this buddhi, which is the one who gains knowledge, has to differentiate itself from the conscious, from me, the conscious being, which it has taken to be itself. Right? And so the self has no problem. The self is free of the mind and body and sense organs and the universe. It has no problem at all. The problem is for the one who's in samsara, in this time-space creation, the jiva. It's the jiva that has the problem, because in having this kind of superimposition, I become, the self, the atma, becomes mortal and moody and everything else you can. Any other quality that you can give to your body, mind, sense organs, you become that, because you're totally identified with that. So the buddhi has to be differentiated from that.
But what my doubt really comes from, because we say the self is not objectifiable, but when we meditate or whatever, and then we say, okay, turn your attention to the self, or somehow we bring ourselves to that, I don't understand how that's not objectifying the self.
Yeah.
To me, that is.
This is the difference. If I turn my attention toward the buddhi, toward anything that actually is objectifiable as a subject-object relationship with me, with the buddhi. So, for instance, if I look at that wall, or I look at this table, or this, even if I look at this body, I can be aware of this body or not. I can be aware of this table, or this stool, or not. Right? In order to be aware of it, for it to be known, it needs to be objectified. It has to be, or it's there, but I don't know it. I'm not experiencing it. So that's clear, right? Mm-hmm. Now, the self is always experienced. It is never not experienced. It is self-evident. So no real objectification is necessary. Only differentiation is necessary. Because you're not going to have a new or objectified experience of the self, because the self is already the luminary and the one who is ever present. So there's not going to be any objectification or new experience of the self, because it's already there. Mm-hmm. It doesn't require objectification.
So I can use the word differentiate.
Needs to be differentiated.
To put a word to how we do that.
Yeah. And so say yourself is completely present, and it is the self of the buddhi, and it is completely free of the buddhi, both. Right? Like the clay is the self of the pot, and it is free of the pot. It doesn't depend upon the pot at all. The pot doesn't even exist, really. That's why we call it maya or mitya. It has no being of its own. So now you are like the pot, like the clay to the pot, in reference to the buddhi. And so now the buddhi needs it to stop doing, just for the time being, is it is always busy objectifying the world, and then the world that it's objectifying, anything that exists within time-space, that it's objectifying, gets the idamvriti, this. You know? If I'm objectifying something that is sattva, like my mind, or even emotions, then I am that. Right? So here, I can say I am this body because of the sense of touch. Means this body is pervaded by consciousness. So I'll identify with the consciousness. I am a conscious being. And which is me, this body. Right? So I take myself to be this body because it's a conscious being. I'm that conscious being. And I feel that body completely. And just like I feel the whole universe completely, but this is different because it has, the body is different because it has a subtle body. It has five sense organs located in it, but pervading the whole body. And so it seems to be a conscious being. So I take myself to be that. That's what we call an ahankar. So now say, in this teaching, we want to help you to differentiate between your own being, the me, and for the buddhi to recognize that that me, that the, for the buddhi, it is its very self, and the self is free of it. Mm-hmm. That's the satyam mitya that the buddhi has to recognize. And it can recognize that, like in meditation, it can recognize that by differentiating that which never is non-objectifiable, which never changes, is self-evident, and the me is me. The me is always me, even if you take it to be the body. Right? You're still only identifying the me that is the real me with this body, or the me that is the real me with the mind. It's not a problem for the self, it's a problem for the mind or the buddhi. But the buddhi is always landing on me, and then the ahankar kind of lassoes something else onto it. It puts some baggage onto it that doesn't belong to it. Mm-hmm. So we have to help the mind to differentiate itself. So how can one way it can do that is, first of all, the mind, the buddhi, is thinking, is changing, you're aware of it. All of the vrittis come and go. And then you can recognize as in this coming and going, the being, the awareness, the conscious being, is not changing at all. That's a fact. And it's a fact that the sattva buddhi, you know, is continually changing. So you can differentiate the changeless from the changing. Mm-hmm. Because you're self-evident, right? So no matter how much it changes or whatever it doesn't make any difference to the self. It doesn't change, it has no problem. Now, when we're doing a meditation, so now this viveka is there. If I can have, I can ask you to turn your mind just gently toward consciousness itself. What that buddhi is then doing is it's turning in on itself instead of looking. What if you're looking for the self? You know, that I'm looking for my Atma. Let me look inside. The one who's looking is the Atma. I mean, the self of the one who's looking is the Atma. And the Atma happens to be the very me, the very self of the buddhi and of the universe. Okay? So I can have the buddhi recognize the one who's illumining it, not as an object. It's already self-evident. And so the buddhi can differentiate itself, its nama-rupa, from the me, which is its own content. But the me is stable. The nama-rupa, the name and form, is not stable.
Yeah. Could you unfold self-evident just a little bit?
Self-evident is, it's literally what it means is it needs nothing, no other means of knowledge to illumine it. It is its own luminary because it's consciousness itself. Whereas everything else in the creation needs a means of knowledge, like your sense organs or whatever, to gain a vritti of that, which is illumined by consciousness, because it's not self-luminous. Where consciousness, you can get rid of the entire creation, and conscious being is just, the me is just me. I'm still absolutely the same. Nothing happens at all because mitya, this whole creation, has no being at all for it to touch or hurt. It's a different order of reality. So the presence or absence of the creation is totally irrelevant to the me-ness of me, to consciousness. And the consciousness being consciousness will illumine anything, you know, that is there. Mm-hmm. Right? So here, this stool doesn't have a subtle body. So it's not saying, you know, I am a stool. It doesn't have an ahankara saying, I am a stool, or anything else, or let me know, who am I really, you know? It doesn't have the problem, you know. But human beings have that problem because they have a subtle body, they've got mind and sense organs that are sattva, that reflect the self as though. And so I as though pervade this body is me, from the standpoint of the body, mind, sense organs. So that needs a differentiation between the subject and object differentiation. And that's where we have these teaching methodologies like Driktrisha Viveka that see or seeing differentiation. And the Avastat Trayasakti means the witness of the three states of experience. And even the Karya Karana, that's also, that we did today a little bit, that's also Prakriya. So these are all just designed to make me recognize the freedom of my own being, which has been, has whole universe superimposed on it. And now from my standpoint, the problem is not the whole universe exactly. The problem is that is me. I'm the one that needs to recognize. I'm the one who feels the bondage, and I'm the one that needs to be released from it, either mind, the buddhi. Is that helpful?
Yeah, it was exactly this differentiation word instead of objectifying.
Yes, differentiation. That's the key word.
The key word is really recognize.
Recognize what is there, the self-evident me that is always there.
Sometimes you say, let the buddhi focus on me,
mm-hmm.
and then sometimes along with that you say, just be me.
Yeah, because what I'm doing there in the meditation is first you're just kind of relaxing your body and letting your mind just be free to just be, just welcoming it, let it kind of do its thing to come, just to settle, you know. And then we can just turn, just as we get more and more relaxed, you can just turn your buddhi, because we've had all of this teaching and we're used to doing this, then you turn your buddhi inward instead of outward toward its own being, you know. And then the buddhi then just wakes up to its own self, the atma, which is itself. It's just the atma is free of it, but it's not free of the atma. So it recognizes that. But still, if I say that, turn your mind to yourself, to the atma, then there's some sort of subject to object differentiation. Or the buddhi, there's some chance of ahankara being still identified with the buddhi. Mm-hmm. And so then we say, just be yourself. And then what you're recognizing at that time is just this, your own self-evident nature, who exactly you are. Because you've already differentiated yourself from all of the things that are objectifiable. But still, what you want, having done all of that, is just to have the aham, the I, land on you. Just be yourself instead of thinking that you're the buddhi focusing on you. Make that switch of the ahankara to make sure the ahankara isn't stuck in the buddhi. You know, when you just focus, the buddhi focuses on itself. It's actually erasing any other type of objectification. Like now, my buddhi, my mind is just awake and it's looking outward through my sense organs, and so I'm having an experience of whatever's in front of me, right? But if I'm withdrawing my sense organs, say in contemplation, and I shut my eyes, and I'm just withdrawing the buddhi from any externalization, you know, so I'm just turning toward myself. I'm turning toward my self-evident me. The buddhi is turning toward the one that's illumining it, the luminary, which doesn't need to be objectified. Everything else needs to be objectified, but the self doesn't. And so I turn my buddhi toward that, toward the one that illumines it, toward the luminary, toward consciousness. And then it's just a subtle, using words, it's just the subtlest shift to now we've, you know, kind of resolved all this. Now just sit there, just be yourself. It's just a tiny little shift of words. You know, that, and just sit there as your own being, your own self-evident being. There's no movement, there's no nothing, nothing is happening except you. And then you recognize at that time the total completeness of yourself. It's not like you're just being you and you want something. You don't want anything. You are everything in the non-dual form. You are everything that could ever be wanted. There's nothing that you can add. Do I want to add anything? Do I want to take anything away? No. No.
And that's it's a little complete. Different than focusing, right?
It's subtle, Edward. I'll tell you. You have to try it.
Oh, okay.
You have to try it. Because it's... like if when you're doing that and you're relaxing and you're just, you know, turning your attention inward so your mind isn't outward. That's just, I can be looking this way, I can be focusing on my own presence. You know, I can be imagining. The Buddha can be doing all kinds of things.
Mm-hmm.
So it can be taking all kinds of different types of vrittis that are just naturally, because it's sattva, they're naturally illumined by consciousness. So we're just quietening the mind down from all of those kind of vrittis and just coming home. We're just bringing the mind home to its own being, really. Bringing the buddhi home to its own being, the truth of itself. But then you can still be with the buddhi. And it's just a subtle shift because the self of the buddhi is yourself. But you're just through the use of words to just be yourself, you're just being like it's being the clay instead of the pot, even though the only thing there is clay. It's being the self instead of the buddhi, even though the self is totally pervades completely the buddhi. So it's something subtle.
Yeah, I see that.
Okay. You more or less have to try it. It's just language, but it makes a little subtle shift.
Yeah.
That is nice to do.
I have a question, please. The way I understand of what I've heard, the consciousness, the being, doesn't have knowledge. It just illuminates everything.
It is knowledge. Or you're thinking of knowledge like different vrittis, like I know this and I've learned about that. Or I'm experiencing this or that.
No, then would you please explain what you just started to say, that it is knowledge? Because I think of it as only
it is
illuminating everything.
But what is that luminary? The if you say something is self-evident, consciousness, it is its own experience, consciousness itself. That very consciousness, we have different words for it that we use in different situations. In reference to a vritti, the vritti, whatever its content is known. Okay? That word, using the word known, this is known, this is known, this is known, or I know that, I know that, I know that, we are really only pointing to self-luminous consciousness.
Mm.
You know, so say, if I look at in the room, this is known, this is known, this is known, this is known, if I took away all of the objects, all objects, what is left is, it is known. That's what we mean by self-luminous. So the knownness, the self-evident consciousness, is what illumines every vritti I have. Then the ahankara and your buddhi can come and comment on that vritti in a lot of different ways, you know. But the knownness itself is the consciousness, self-evident consciousness, the self-shining. It doesn't need a pramana to light it up.
Is that one with Atman? The is-knownness?
Is Atma.
It is not right.
It is Atma.
There's no distinction.
No.
We're talking about this today.
Oh, yeah. You know, it is Atma. It's language. See, this is the thing. You are always having that self-evident conscious being experience. Not as an object, just as you.
Okay.
It is always, always there. But the whole world, which is mitya, is not away from it in any way, because mitya has no independent being. And so the whole universe is always enjoying self-evident consciousness. But now, in reference to our experience as jivas in this world, this self-evident consciousness, we use language to identify it experientially. Like if I say, for instance, it is known, it is known, it is known, I am giving the self-evident consciousness experience, which is its own non-dual experience, I am giving it to these objects by saying, it is known, it is known, it is known, it is known. I should be saying, self-evident consciousness, self-evident consciousness, self-evident consciousness. But we don't talk that way. We say, it is known, it is known, it is known, and then we realize there is nothing that is not known. Any vritti, any experience you have, it is and it is known. The isness experience is the sat. There is no other isness experience. There's no other one at all. Isness, being. being. There is no thing that enjoys being. All of these things are mitya, and so they are never away from being. So the isness that we experience and attribute to this object is. If I get rid of all of the objects, then what is left is being, which is me. I am. I am without the body, mind, sense organs, without the universe. My amness is. And that amness is known because it is consciousness. Being and consciousness are one and the same thing. They're not different. And so with language, that self-evident consciousness is labeled as it is. Take away all of that, isness is left. It is known. These are just words that are identifying self-evident consciousness that are superimposed by the body, mind, sense organs on the self.
I thought that the consciousness, when it was shining or illuminating, the only way that it was known, the beingness was known, was being through the buddhi.
No. Yeah, the knownness is the self.
It's known as itself.
Go ahead. What do you mean?
As distinct objects, as name and form come in only through the buddhi.
Yes.
In the Atman, it's known just as itself.
Yes. If this is what you mean, that the knownness is consciousness. If there's no subject-object relationship within consciousness, it's just self-evident. It's self-evident being. It doesn't require a pramana or a means of knowledge or anything like that to light it up. I simply am known without a knower. That I am the knownness. Consciousness itself is knownness is a synonym for the consciousness experience itself, which is not subject-object. Is that what you're saying? That's right.
So yeah. Consciousness is knowledge?
What do you mean by knowledge?
Well, that it's aware of itself.
Well, when we say aware of itself, like knowledge to me, if I use knowledge, somehow that has some objectifiable quality. If you're using the word knowledge as just consciousness without any subject-object relationship, if you get rid of the whole universe, that self-evident being is all that is there. And you're calling that knowledge, that doesn't work for me. But if it works for you...
Well, knowledge of itself?
It doesn't have knowledge of itself because that's a duality there. It is consciousness. So it is that experience without any subject-object relationship. When you say knowledge of itself, how can it have knowledge of itself? It is that knowledge.
Well, if there's nothing else there,
yeah.
Then there's nothing.
If there's nothing else there, the only thing else there would be mitya. So yes, there's really nothing else there. But because mitya has no independent being, so mitya just totally enjoys for its being self-evident consciousness. But within the mitya, some things reflect self-evident consciousness and some things don't. Jivas, or things that have a sukshma sharira, reflect self-evident consciousness, and things that don't, like the stool, they just enjoy being from their own standpoint.
So that's what consciousness does. It just enjoys its... Well, no, it doesn't enjoy either.
Yeah, enjoy... When we use that, that's an Indian way of using the word enjoy. It has... The nature of being is its nature.
But it's just being.
It's just being. Beingness. Mm-hmm. Beingness is consciousness, but this doesn't have a subtle body from its own perspective to reflect that consciousness.
So it's just existence, but if there's nothing else but the consciousness, then there's nothing that it illumines.
It's not performing any verb to illumine anything. It's not a verb. Here we... See, you can't say there's nothing that it illumines because here we all are. But it's not performed, it's not illumining it as a verb. It's illumining it because it is consciousness and everything is enjoying, everything has that consciousness that is in with mitya, because mitya is like the pot of the clay. You know, we probably, I would say, sit with this for a while. I'm going to have to circle around it in a lot of different ways, and all of a sudden things will start clicking together. This particular thing isn't completely working for you yet. That's okay. It doesn't matter. Because there's many other...
It's awesome.
Yeah.
No, it really stops the mind.
It's confusing. I mean, the language is really...
Mm. Our whole language
is... I find it confusing.
The definition.
That's right. Definition.
Well, you know, our language is really meant, is a language for mitya. For everything within mitya. All of our verbs, all of our subject-object relationship, everything is only working, really only works within duality. None of the words that we use are meant to land on consciousness, because consciousness is not one of the objects in the creation, right? But it is the self of the creation. It is the innermost content of the entire creation. But how to talk about that? How, and really the talking about it is, has to be talked about in such a way as to help you identify and differentiate the conscious being that you are, where the me really lands, from all of the experiences that come and go. Like you have a body, you have a mind, you have sense organs, they're all changing. The body eventually, you know, is born and it dies. And along the way it's continually changing. You're sense organs are changing, your perceptions are changing, the vrittis in your mind are all changing, but there's something that is not changing. So this is where the viveka comes in. You are not changing, everything else is. But the buddhi has to recognize that, because the buddhi is totally, because of self-ignorance, is totally identified with the self. It takes itself and all of its qualities to belong to the self. It says, I am the existent being, and I'm thinking and doing this and doing that. Mm. And that just, that's not true. The self is not doing this and doing that.
We do call... We do call it a conscious being.
Because conscious being is the existence. Being is the sat. Consciousness is the chit. So being is consciousness. Consciousness is being. Being is existence is consciousness. Consciousness is existence. There's not two things there.
It's not two things.
Mm-mm. Yeah. Consciousness, which is existence. Existence, which is consciousness. They're not two things. They're only one thing.
So in the being...
Go ahead.
We've never
been... Being is not an entity. Being is just...
Existence.
Amness.
Yeah.
So it's not being and being.
I was going to ask something else.
Go ahead.
So in the be yourself meditation, if I feel that my mind keeps trying to get involved with the be yourself part, that's probably normal, and that's where
that's normal.
Be
and well, no, yeah, you can be, but if you can just be yourself, the one that's not changing, you know, and just relax and let the mind be doing whatever it wants to. You're still there, not changing.
Yeah. I feel like the mind keeps trying to narrate my experience.
It does, but just relax and let it. Oh. Just be yourself. Nothing is, no matter what your mind's doing, it's not touching you. Mm. And that's why we say, you know, relax. Let the mind waft through and do its thing. Just let it be. You know, we think we want to shut all of these things down. We can do meditations like that too. But it's also important to see that when you're thinking and emoting, feeling, or whatever, that yourself isn't changing in any way. That's the viveka. Without that viveka, discrimination, then you take yourself to be the mind when it's quiet. Now I'm myself. Because my mind is quiet and not in my way. So I wait for these sukha vrittis or these shanta vrittis. Then that's me. But you're not a shanta vritti. The mind is having a shanta vritti, not you. You know, so you have to recognize the self that is present in the luminary, the consciousness, which all vrittis enjoy. And there's a viveka necessary for that, the discrimination necessary. You should see in a dukkha vritti, you're completely, fully there. Nothing is happening to you. The dukkha vritti is not the best vritti. We don't want dukkha, these sorrowful vrittis. Dukkha means sorrow, suffering. We don't want suffering. We don't want it to suffer. We don't want to have the negative spectrum of vrittis because they don't resonate with me. It's like a having an ant, you know, some sort of a germ or something. Mm-hmm. You know. But what's important is that I recognize that myself is not touched by any vritti. It's not touched by any emotion. I'm exactly the same conscious being. But the thing is that emotions pervade the mind. They're different than just a thought. They pervade and they have some longevity because they have more to do with the tension in the mind than with the changing objects, changing perceptions. Like say, for instance, your mind is very active doing this and thinking about that, but it's extremely relaxed. You're having a shanta vritti, and at the same time you're engaged. It doesn't, the nama rupas don't, the names and forms and what you're thinking are not affecting the relaxation, the shanti of that string of vrittis. But now say you have a reaction. Well, the reaction creates some stress in the mind, which you label as agitation or sorrow or suffering. Depends on what the level of the agitation, the quality of the agitation. We have lots of names for these things. And this one happens to be agitation. This one's like this. That stress is anger. You know, we have names for these. But that's why these emotions last longer, because they have to do with stress. Whereas the vrittis themselves, the nama rupas, have to do with just the use of the sensory perception or the function of imagination or the function of memory. They don't have to do with stress. So you could have, your mind could be relaxed and calm, and you could be having all kinds of memories and just thinking about the past and this and that, and everything is fine. It's all shanti, there's no problem. Or you could be in sorrow, and as you think about all of these things, sorrowfully, you're having all of these vrittis, all of these different nama rupas. So the emotions are different. They have to be handled differently than just the vrittis because the emotion will pervade the string of vrittis that you're having. Because Swamiji will often say, because it's a type of stress in the mind. That's why when you're having the negative spectrum of emotions, what you can do is welcome them into the buddhi, which you are consciously relaxing. And that affects very much the manas or the emotion. Because as the buddhi accepts it and it relaxes, welcoming it, then the stressed manas comes into the relaxed buddhi. Kind of like that. And so you find the problem in the manas, in the mind, the emotion, you know, dissipates. Because you're giving up the stress. To give up the stress, you know, you have to understand that there's stress involved for the experience of that emotion. Constriction, maybe a better word also is constriction is a good word. There's a constriction in the mind or in the heart. Even the body becomes constricted when the emotion, when the mind is constricted, the body becomes constricted also. Emotions are kind of a different, and the emotions are basically our big problem, not the perceptions. Yeah. So we have to learn, even just think of like when you're doing inner child work with an emotion. You know, you're giving that little child emotion, you're giving it love and a sense of self-worth, all of the things that self-respect, you know. You're a beautiful little girl. You're such a beautiful little girl. I think I just love you just as you are. You know, in whatever ways you talk, then that little constricted part starts to relax. And it releases a lot of toxic stuff. stuff that's been being held in the body, even. Because the way you're talking to it and holding it, allows a person to relax. It causes the inner points of constriction that we're holding inside to relax. It's not that different from what goes on outside, you know.
For me, that is like a heat is also releasing from the body.
Heat, yeah. Yeah, often. Mm. Yeah. And it feels good too.
Mm-hmm.
It feels so good for that, like that heat and the constriction to go. It's very, very physical experience.
It seems that like the pramana works the best is that when the mind is aware of where the teacher is pointing to. The teacher is pointing to that which is always here, always full, always complete, and always one. So if the mind of the jiva, of the student, can see exactly what is pointing to, then it can sort of see what the teacher sees at the time. Can you elaborate on that?
Well, the teacher is wielding the different prakriyas, different teaching methodologies that are taking you step by step. If I'm using a prakriya, I'm also experiencing that prakriya. Because as I'm talking about it, I'm seeing it. As I'm saying it, I'm seeing it. And as I move in, I'm seeing that, and landing on just myself. So both of us, by the utilization of that particular prakriya, are experiencing that prakriya, you know. And so say your mind and the teacher's mind are there's nothing blocking that kind of union between the two minds. It's really only one mind taking place. There's no ego there on either side. There's only on the side of the teacher and the side of the student. There's just knowledge taking place. And so the knowledge is happening in the teacher. If it's not happening, if you're using a prakriya and it's not happening for you, it's not happening. Right? So the knowledge is happening for both of you in exactly the same way, actually, if there's no obstructions. Now, obstructions can be of different sorts. It can be the problem with Shraddha, but it can also be, you know, we have things that are hurting us or bothering us or taking our attention, even though we're trying to pay attention. There's a lot of other things going on inside that are that I'm thinking about, so I'm not fully present because I'm distracted. Even if I'm trying to be fully present, sometimes I'm just distracted with some hurts or pains or things that are bothering me. But when there's no distraction and there's nothing, that's why we say this sahana bhavaturina, that Bhagavan bless us, and that let there be no enmity between the teacher and the student, because then your mind's just thinking about that, you know. You have this problem and that problem, you don't like this person, you don't like your teacher. And that's what you're thinking about. And your mind's not available. So that's why we do this prayer, sahana bhavatu, at least at this time, let there not be anything between us. So that this knowledge can be the only thing that's there, and I can, then the mind that the teacher's experiencing is the mind that the student is experiencing. And that's how it's supposed to be, actually. And also, each step along the way of any given prakriya, there's a seeing involved. You see this, and then seeing this, you recognize it. You recognize this, then you see this. If you can see this, then you can go to the next step and see this, and then you can see that, and then you can see that, and then you land up at the self. Right?
Yes, exactly.
Yeah,
the teacher is just pointing to that, and the student
should be on board.
Follow,
yeah,
and see what is being pointed to, and then because it's exactly the same.
It's exactly the same. It's one thing. It's one self. And if it's in my mind, say if I'm teaching the class, if in my mind that pointer is there, then your mind will be there too, as long as, again, the words that we're using have been properly defined, because any word has so many meanings, you know. So these, there's a lot going on around any given prakriya to get us all on board with the exact meaning of the word. So that's why that takes a lot of words to make the meaning of that word known, because we all have our own definitions. You know, I'm not talking just about words consciousness or something. I'm just talking about words in general. Of course, we do mean consciousness and existence and knownness, you know.
As long as you used to use the word grace, that it requires grace to be able to sort of to be able to gain this knowledge. But
it's called Ishwara Anugraha, grace of Ishwara.
Do you sort of feel we could use a better word than grace rather than, because the,
you could say punya.
Yes, but
sometimes punya is grace.
Because some might sort of think, well, I haven't earned enough grace to get this knowledge. So is there a
I actually think that what the tradition actually says is, if you make it to a teacher and this knowledge is taking place, you have enough grace to get it.
Okay.
Yeah, otherwise you wouldn't be here.
Thank you.
That's
I did want to say that what you said yesterday was helpful to me.
Oh, you worked on it?
I thought about it, it made sense.
Yeah. Where'd you go with it?
Well, I was in the hospital last January and they put me under.
Yeah.
And I reflected on that, and that experience was different than deep sleep. I really did kind of have a strange experience of popping out of nowhere when the anesthetic wore off, and normally waking up from a deep sleep isn't like that.
It's not like that. It's very... Mm-hmm. But oh, great. What's with the leg?
Like you're outside.
Need a drink of water.
No, you don't come outside.
No, I don't want to go outside.
Forget about it.
When you're burping like that, we're going to look at you.
I do sometimes need a drink.
What?
I sometimes do need a drink. Got a dry throat.
It's fine.
Mike does that sometimes. Piece of straw stuck in his mouth.
Like,
it's just, yeah. Sometimes I'll just get funky stuff.
You know, yeah. And also, when he goes and he goes and stands in the river, you know, and then, and so does Shweta now, not quite as deeply, but because of the cold, he'll start kind of choking and coughing and from the guy freezing, and he just does that.
Oh, that's like brrr.
He might need water, but we're giving him quite a bit of water, and he has a lot of water. Yes, he's been drinking water. Part of his kidney problems makes him also want to drink a lot of water, so he actually drinks a lot of water and then has to go to the bathroom a lot also, because that's why you have to take him out at night. Because
he didn't go to the bathroom when he
went for a walk. Yeah. They'll still need to go out around 3.
Wow.
Usually. I always do it because he could normally hold it, but in his condition, it's not easy to do that.
Mm.
Yeah, so...
I
can
relate to that. Yeah.
Thanks for sharing.
Your email.
Yeah.
Can I still ask a question?
Sure.
So this morning you said Ishwara has some pain. Something like that.
Oh yeah, that's yeah. It's not that Ishwara has pain, but if pain is taking place in the creation and he's omniscient, then he's illumining that pain from the standpoint of the upadi. He's not from the standpoint of the self, but from the standpoint of the upadi, there's a perception of that pain. Like, just like imagine, say you have a lucid dream, say you have an imagination, and in the imagination something painful is happening, mm-hmm. then even though you're not experiencing pain, you're aware of the pain. That is what's meant. That's a little discussion. That's not really in the Upanishads. There's a discussion about that in the Brahma Sutras. Mm. Yeah. It's not that Bhagavan has pain, that the self doesn't have pain.
Is it empathy?
No, it's not empathy. It's that pain exists. Okay. And that the existence of that pain is illumined by the Satchit.
So it's kind of like matter-of-factly.
Matter-of-factly, there's the experience of pain, not the identity, not the identification with it.
Right.
There's an objectivity, not an identification.
Just like death happens, pain happens.
Yeah. But still, pain is pain. Death is death. Experience is experience.
You also said that, you know, self-knowledge about yourself is direct and immediate, sat-sat. But then you said, that knowledge of Ishvara is indirect knowledge. You need.
What I was saying, I don't think I want to open that up right now.
Oh,
but
okay.
I'll talk for a minute, and then we can get into it maybe tomorrow because it's a big topic.
Yeah.
But just in brief, yourself is self-evident, so you have direct, immediate knowledge of that by removing the superimposition. By viveka, because yourself is already experientially present. Your prarabdha karma, your experience of the universe, is experientially present. So that's direct, immediate knowledge. Mithya is direct, immediate knowledge. That's just not some hypothetical thing. They're talking about something to be recognized here and now, the nature of yourself here and now. Yeah. But in terms of, say, the transmigration of the jiva, That's indirect knowledge, unless you yourself have, you know, had the experience of transmigrating. You have shraddha in the vision of the shruti. It also makes emotional sense to you. It works for you. Yeah. You know? It works for you. Now, what about the creation being cyclical? That's from the shastra, you know. What about that the Ishvara, that there is Ishvara, and Ishvara reflects, because sattva running through Ishvara reflects consciousness, so this whole creation is a conscious being. It makes sense, you understand it, in the scheme of things, you know, that's how it should be, just logically. But you can't experience that Maya Upadi from the standpoint of this jiva, that infinite Maya Upadi, you know. There's infinite, there is such thing as, you know, inference and infinite extension, logical infinite extensions and all things that make it seem, you know, how it has to be. But you're not having an experience of the Ishvara Upadi. So, but there's more to say.
Yeah.
And so you're asking for like a big, big class in that question. For me to do it in a way that I think is meaningful.
Yeah, that.
Yeah. Not tonight, though.
I found it confusing because I think I've heard you said that the reincarnation is just a belief. And to me, I cannot see it as a belief.
Well, we could.
For me, it seems like.
Yeah.
Of course.
Mm. For me, it's of course also.
Mm. Otherwise, and we were talking about the self is always there. So when the body dies, where would it go to unmanifest then?
The body?
No, the self.
Oh, I see.
Because it's still there, so it must have some kind of experience or going to unmanifest.
Well, maybe, you know, if I say belief, another way we can say it is it's indirect knowledge. And the reason it's indirect knowledge is because even though it makes total sense, it's logical, I can't imagine it being any other way, you don't have the direct experience of reincarnation.
You can't prove it.
But we don't have a direct experience of the kalpa.
No, we don't.
So, but we talk about that as knowledge.
Indirect knowledge, not direct knowledge.
So, but you haven't used the word belief there.
If I use the word belief, I could as well use the word indirect knowledge.
Okay.
I could just use only indirect knowledge. But people talk about reincarnation as though they believe in it or they don't believe in it. And so then I can talk about the difference between direct knowledge and indirect knowledge.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. What would Lucky like to talk about?
Mm-hmm. He'd like to talk about going to bed. He's already gone to bed. Mm-hmm. Let's say a prayer. It's getting late. Om Swasti Prajabhyah Paripalayantam Nyayena Margena Mahim Mahishaha Ko Brahmanebhyah Shivamastu Nityam Loka Samasta Sukhino Bhavantu Kale Varshatu Parajanyaha Prithivi Sasya Shalini Desho Yamsho Barahitaha Brahmana santu nirbhayaha Om sarve bhavantu sukhinaha Sarve santu niramayaha Sarve bhadrani pashyantu Ma kaschid dukha bhak bhavet Asato ma sadgamaya Tamaso ma jyotirgamaya Mrityorma amatangamaya Om Purnamadav Purnamidam Purnat Purnamudachyate Purnasya Purnamadaya Purnamevavasishyate Om Shanti Shanti Shantihi Harihi Om Shri Gurubhyo Namaha Harihi Om. Om, that's it. I'll just tell you one little thing without getting into it. Nobody can say anything, so I'm just going to say it and walk away. Knowledge, let's say just inference, any inference that we make, requires an initial statement. It's called a pratignya. Any inference, even in the world, you need to have an initial statement. And then you infer off of that initial statement, and the initial statement has to be true. If the initial statement isn't true, the inference will be false. So that's what we call the pratignya. When we're talking about things about the nature of the creation, the nature of Ishwara, the nature of reincarnation, the initial statement comes from the Shruti. And so if you accept the Shruti, the Upanishads, the Vedas, as a pramana, as an authority, as a means of knowledge, then in accepting that initial statement, right, then it is so completely logical, and how could it be otherwise? But if that Shraddha is not there, then what for us is indirect knowledge, and how could it be otherwise, is just a belief, because you don't have the Shraddha in the Vedas to be able to accept the initial statement with some openness, you know? Because without that initial statement, without the Shruti, you can't prove such a thing. Now, even the Buddha talked about different experiences that he had, transmigrating and all of some, you know, psychic type of experiences that he actually had, that explained reincarnation to him. He saw the truth of it and explained it to him. So for the Buddhists, his words were the Shabda Pramana. They had Shraddha in his experience. And so accepting that, then they could accept, you know, kind of all of the logical syllogisms and everything that can be established off of that. So many other things come in to support it. But if you dismiss the initial statement that you yourself haven't had an experience of, then it's just somebody's belief. So Shraddha in the Vedas themselves become important. But this is a topic. I'm just saying it so that I remember to bring it up when we have class. Are you ready to go to bed? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.